What's my story about the Beam? So I used to work as a, way back, used to work as a Ruby developer. And I was always that one with the book about Haskell or Clojure or something like that. We should do this thing instead. Look, it's better for all these reasons.
What's up, everybody? Thanks for tuning in to Beam Radio.
Welcome back to Beam Radio. During this very special episode, we will find out about the new kid on the Beam, I guess. But first, I just want to quickly introduce our lovely hosts. So we have Alex Kutmus.
Howdy, howdy.
And we have Bruce Tate.
Hi, from Chattanooga, Tennessee.
And before we introduce our lovely guests, we should just shout out the sponsors. So, Bruce, you're finally on when I'm recording and shouting out the sponsorship. So what's going on at Groxio?
Yeah, we're fast and furious preparing for Gig City Elixir, and that's going to be in mid-May. Very excited. We've added you and Andrea to the lineup, so we're excited about that.
Yeah, and now I'm going to bring up your lovely typo again, because the tweet that announces that I am a keynote speaker at Gig City Elixir gives me the best name ever, Lars Walkman.
Autocorrect, huh?
Yeah. And I wonder if your autocorrect is from the 80s to achieve that. I am happy to take like Sony 70s to 80s swag and just go with that. So Lars Walkman is probably my new American name. Meanwhile, on the Underjord side, we have some fun stuff coming out. So I have a collab with Tigris Data. They do the object storage for fly.io. So expect to see more live streams. Expect to see more writing, because now I have some time on the regular schedule to put into that. So that's going to be fun. Also, if anyone needs Elixir consultants, I might have a few to shift around. So reach out if that's the case. All right, let's get to it. Today we're joined by the Gleam core team. There are so many rhymes around Gleam and the Beam. So yeah, I'll not go too deep into that, but welcome to the show, Louis Pilfeld and Haley Thompson. It's Thompson,
thank
right?
you.
Yeah, it is Thompson. Wasn't looking at the notes.
Hi.
Hey, it's really good to be here.
I'm so glad to finally have you on. I had to chase you down multiple times because you're all so kind of humble and don't want to go shouting about the thing you're building. But lovely to finally have you on. And it kind of coincides with Gleam going 1.0. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. It's been super exciting.
So exciting.
Long time coming.
So how long has that journey been now?
Oh, that's a horrible question. I don't want to think about that. A very long time. Gosh, I think 2018 is when I properly started development, which is seems like a lifetime ago. But then at the same time, things that seemed like yesterday turned out to be 2021, 22. So it's all very warped at the moment.
Eternity started at about 2019, I think.
Yeah.
All right. We have one question that we always ask our guests, and it sets us up pretty well for talking about Gleam, I think. Take it in any order you like, but what is your story with the Beam?
Ooh. I'll go first. What's my story about the Beam? So I used to work as a, way back, used to work as a Ruby developer. And I was always that one with the book about Haskell or Clojure or something like that. We should do this thing instead. Look, it's better for all these reasons. And then I was quite junior at the time, and one of the seniors just came over and gave me a book about Elixir and says, I think you should read this. And I did, and it just blew my mind. And All this excitement for all these other languages got focused purely in Elixir, and then discovering Erlang and all that sort of stuff, and it just sort of took over everything, really. And that was about when Elixir was just version 1 or so. And then I made lots of tooling for Elixir, like I made the first Elixir formatter and the first linter and that kind of thing. And then at some point I started doing this other thing called Gleam, which is sadly means I don't write as much Elixir these days, but I'm still very much a Beamer.
That's what this radio is about. So We might mostly have Elixir folks on the panel, but that's mostly availability. We should actually try to pin down an Erlanger, and maybe it's time to bring on someone from Gleam. I've also run into your calendar library. So calendar.
Oh yeah, I made that Elixir calendar thing. Yeah. I had a really ambitious project that involved like scheduling calendars and all sorts of things, and then I just made the calendar library and then didn't make the product. So I just like had to fix bugs for a thing I didn't use for 5 years.
Yeah. That's how it goes.
Yeah.
How about you, Haley?
I'm actually a bit of a fresh face to the Beam. So Gleam is actually my introduction to Beam and Erlang and Elixir. I'm mostly like a front end person, but I met Louis at a house party, like 2019, maybe. And after a lot of conversation about Elm, eventually got sort of tricked into checking out Gleam, and then had a bit of a mind blow when I realized that the Elm architecture looks an awful lot like an Erlang process, like a gen server or something like that. And now I'm stuck here. Slowly doing less and less front end, finding myself doing a lot more Beam.
How does that feel?
Yeah, actually, it's pretty cool. I was always someone that was like adamantly against doing back end. I was like, oh no, I can do everything I want to do in the front end. And slowly, all of my walls are being broken down, and I'm actually having a good time.
I think the Beam does that. I remember when I first started learning Elixir, all these things that just seemed like something that other engineers make, I could suddenly do. You know, all those like big multi-core things and you know, things that are much more akin to databases than simple web apps. I was like, wow, this is within my power now. I think it's a fantastic ecosystem for that. It makes a lot of things possible.
Yeah, and it seems like the further that we go, the more that we push into the infrastructure, the more becomes possible, right? So we're kind of in this magical time when, you know, we're seeing this explosion of productivity and capability.
Mm. Especially once you bring in things like Live View and that new integration the Phoenix guys have just dropped with Fly, where you can just like spin up a whole new server as if it's just a process somewhere. Like that's fantastically cool stuff.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You can kind of treat your application more as like an operating system as opposed to just like a dumb application. So yeah, the was it Flame? I think is the name of that project where you could just spin up
the one. Yeah.
Spin up stuff on demand. So yeah, your application can provision other machines. It can run its own cron jobs. It can you could host web apps. It's amazing all the things you can encompass in just one deployable unit. And it's all covered by unit tests if you so choose. It's pretty amazing what you could do on one platform. So you guys mentioned that, or I guess Haley, you mentioned that Elm looks a lot like Gleam. So for somebody that, you know, I didn't do any Elm, I've read a few blog posts about it, and it always seemed interesting, but I never ventured there. I always used Vue back in my front end days. But can you maybe unpack how Gleam kind of looks like Vue, or how Gleam kind of looks like Elm, or the other way around?
Yeah, I can do my best. I think both Gleam and Elm have quite similar ideas around language design in 80% of the way. So like a pretty tight focus on simplicity and onboarding for new users, this sort of thing. pretty small scope in terms of the language. We've got pretty similar type systems. We have pretty similar libraries for doing like front end things. and then I guess Elm veers off in a very Haskell inspired direction and takes pretty stark departure from Gleam. And I think that's maybe one of the things that I find so interesting about Gleam, or like exciting, compelling is probably a better word, is that you get a lot of the nice beginner-friendly onboardingness, but then you don't ever really have to stray into monads and, you know, Haskell inspired like function composition and like weird operators and all these sorts of things. But actually the point I was trying to make was that the way Elm models your front end in terms of like state updates, that's actually super similar to like what you have with gen servers in Erlang or Elixir. And that was like a huge light bulb moment for me, like coming into Gleam, because I realized I could use a lot of my Elm knowledge in terms of just like general programming, problem solving. And then it turned out that actually all of my knowledge on just like how to build applications transferred really, really easily to like OTP as well.
Yeah. I spent a year or two with an Elm code base before I looked at Gleam. I was probably a year and a half into that Elm code base when I looked at Gleam for the first time. And I'm like, huh, because I've read so much Elm, this is very straightforward. I think I kind of prefer it. I haven't built anything with it yet, but just going through the guide, it was like, this seems like Elm with some of the edges filed off. Like, Elm is not a big language, but it is. It has parts where it gets a little bit nerdier than it has to.
Yeah, and I kind of like the way that you framed that, Haley. It's the idea that the language is kind of built around reduce, right? That idea that you just kind of measure things in reductions. It's really the same way that we talk about things on the Beam. So it kind of maps so well.
Yeah, your Elm front end ends up being one gen server, typically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unless you just another process.
Yeah, unless you do multiple components and kind of tie them together from JavaScript land or something. But generally, you have the one. And yeah, it ends up being very, very similar. So I know there are, I saw part of your talk at Codebeam Berlin, Haley, and then you were covering the web framework end of Gleam. Maybe that's worth getting into at this point.
Yeah, sure. I maintain a library called Lustre, which is kind of shamelessly a clone of Elm, but just like sort of implemented in Gleam, with some of those rough edges filed off and a bunch of nice features added on top. And actually my like main takeaway that I wanted people to get from that talk, which was actually an idea that I had pretty close to the deadline, which Louis just stole from me, was the front end is another process. It's another actor. Lustre very naturally thinks of your front end, your client components like that.
So now is this like LiveView, or is this more you're building the front end in Gleam, or are you building the back end in Gleam? Because I guess based on the landing page of Gleam, you can compile Gleam into JavaScript or Erlang. So maybe we distinguish what Lustre is building towards. Like, what is it targeting, and where does it get deployed, and where does it run?
So if the question is, does Lustre run on the front end or the back end?
Yes, that's much better put than what I did.
The answer is yes. It runs on both. It does the live view thing. It also does the Helm front end single page application thing. You write one Lustre app, you choose where you want to run it.
And more than that, you can choose which parts you want to run away as well, which I think is really quite compelling. Because, you know, we always end up with this this sort of slight irritation with live view, in that there's some part of the application you want to be a lot more snappy and optimistic and not necessarily do like a round trip, or like to survive a bit better if you've got poor networking problems. Well, you could, if you're using Lustre, just say, well, that part is going to be, you know, all that state is going to be managed on the client that doesn't need a server connection, and that can stay super snappy the whole time without having to like go, okay, well, this bit I'm going to have to use React instead of using Elixir. So I think that's really cool.
But what's the point? I heard React shipped React server components, so.
The thing with React server components is that they don't hold state. They render once. They're one and done.
I think they render sequentially as well. So like if you've got four on the page, they waterfall, which is, that's not good. Sequential computation? I don't think I have to say that on Beam Radio.
Yeah, it seems to be a bit of a kerfuffle about that. And it sounds like what Lustre is offering is kind of the holy grail that, like, I like LiveView, but I also feel like there is still an itch to scratch in terms of, like, offline first. And if you're talking about offline first, that pulls in a need to do routing. That pulls in state management. That pulls in transformations. You probably don't want to write those twice, because then you're back to separate front end and back end, separate code bases, maintaining contracts. And there's no current way to compile Elixir to JavaScript or WebAssembly.
There was a Elixir to JavaScript project, and it looked like it was getting like dangerously usable, and then it just sort of vanished overnight. I'd love to know what happened there. Actually, no.
Are
we
talking
care.
About Elixir script or Elixir script, Lumen Firefly?
I know what happened to Lumen. I want someone to pick up one or either of those projects and bring it back to life, because I thought they were super cool. But until then, you're just gonna have to use Gleam. Sorry.
Well, I hear Gleam has types, and some people really, really like their types.
Mm-hmm. Some people don't, though. Yeah. I think that's a big bit. So, you know, people keep asking me, you're competing with Elixir. It's like, I don't think that the people who love macros and dynamic types and you know, that style of programming are going to drop everything and start writing Gleam. Like, Gleam's for a different... Gleam, I think, is about enabling a different set of people with different preferences to come and join the Beam. Like, that, I think that's the important bit. Like, we're not going to get the Scala programmers and the Go programmers to come write Elixir. But they might want to write Gleam.
You might get the OCaml developers.
We definitely are getting a lot of attention from the OCaml lot. They're lovely. They keep doing streams featuring little bits of Gleam and stuff. I've been
watching a little bit of Leandro, who did Caramel on the Beam.
He's a great guy.
Yeah,
he's lovely.
A lovely guy.
I'm convinced he doesn't sleep with the amount of stuff he puts out.
Well, actually, he was on the Swedish Cold Snack podcast recently, and he mentioned that he does sleep and doesn't stay up all night anymore and all of that. So I think he's grown up and become a proper human.
Is
but
that why he's
what I was going to say, like, he's working on bringing the Beam to OCaml, because he found it difficult to bring OCaml to the Beam in a good way.
Louis, I would love to hear about what some of the big moments in the first few years of Gleam's existence have been in your eyes. What are some of the breakthroughs that you've had?
That moment when you run your first program feels like nothing else. Like, scoring the winning goal at the World Cup or something. That was just like, yes, I printed to the console. Amazing. So I'll always remember that one. But yeah, it's just been a stream of lots of little wow moments. You know, like the first time you sort of discover someone using it who isn't your friend, or isn't someone you've known for a while, or the first time somebody starts, you know, using it in their business, betting their livelihood on it to some degree. And like recently with the, you know, we're doing V1 and all these streamers and influencers started to pick it up. Like every single wave of these things is just wonderful and humbling. To the point where I've got a little I've got a folder on my computer called Nostalgia, which is just screenshots of things that were just kind of lovely, like nice comments from people and accomplishments. And then I go back and look at it every like 6 months and go, oh, do you remember that? That was great. But it's just been constantly delightful, really. I'm very lucky.
I'm glad it has been that, because attention is not always fun and desirable. But it also seems like you've worked pretty hard at fostering a fun and friendly crew around Gleam. Like your Discord seems like a happy place.
Thank you. Yeah, we put a lot of effort actually into community, not just building but shaping, you know, setting appropriate expectations about the way that you should treat each other and the way you should communicate, and you know, just really basic stuff that frankly shouldn't need to be said, but if you make sure it really is said, it does actually pay dividends, I think. Or at least it's either working, we've got lucky for some other reason. And it isn't that I don't get bizarre messages. Especially now we've done V1, I've started to get a lot of, not a lot, but like a notable uptick in just like really unpleasant, strange messages. That makes me wonder what it's like to be like a proper influencer. But from talking to other large open source maintainers, like talking to the team who run Exorcism, the coding website, it sounds like I'm getting off very lightly, because as soon as you're a public figure trying to give away something for free, people become very rude and entitled and horrible, really. But on the whole, everyone's been really nice. We're very lucky, but we put a lot of work into it, so.
It's almost like the metaprogramming part of your community, right? It's the conversations about the conversations.
Yeah, a weird meta problem. You know, it's like running a team of developers. I'm not trying to write code anymore because it's easier for me to. Well, that's not true. The focus is not the writing code. The focus is like, how can I enable all these people to make great things with this this set of tools we've got. We've had a great burst of compiler contributors lately, which is fantastic, because with the amount of activity, I don't have as much time to write code as I'd like to. So I've passed the baton over to these people, and I think they're better programmers than me anyway, so that's quite good.
What was the kind of mark for getting to 1.0? I haven't tracked it so closely that I know what like the blockers were, like this has to be there for 1.0.
So there was a few features. So really abstractly, it needs two things. It needs to have been used enough that I feel confident that every decision has been tested enough to discover any mistakes and problems. And there were lots of mistakes and problems. Things that I decided, you know, 5-6 years ago, after a bunch of people have been writing programs, you go, oh, that's rubbish. It wasn't a bad decision, but like there's all these things I didn't consider which caused problems. So we had to learn what all those things are and then fix them. So that's a load of breaking changes. So we definitely can't do V1 until we've gone through that cycle, you know, enough times. And the other thing is that there are things that we definitely do need and are definitely not going to be controversial that we can't add after V1, because that would be again a massive break and change. And the last big example of that was exhaustiveness checking. So the idea that you make sure your case expressions have a clause for every single possible value. So if you've got a list, you need to have like, you know, empty list of one, list of two, etc., etc. And we just didn't have that for a long time. I think that was like issue number, I don't know, 30 or something in the tracker. And when I closed it, we were at issue 2000 or some. it just sort of loomed over me, making me feel really bad. But it turns out it's like a surprisingly tricky computer science thing, exhaustiveness checking. And I just never found the time and capacity to tackle it. And then I did. And it just went on forever, and I kept being stuck, and I was reading these papers and getting confused, and I sort of rage quit at some point, and just sort of put it on the shelf and left it alone for a month or two, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna go back to it now, and then I picked it up and fixed it in half a day. So I was like, I was this close to the finish line, just had no idea whatsoever.
And then sounds like you need another screenshot for the nostalgia folder of when that was merged.
Oh, that was a great feeling. Oh, no, it wasn't actually. I just felt suspicious. You know, when you deliver something, you're like, it seems to be working, but I'm sure it can't be. There must be something else wrong with it. Which it turned out there was, but it wasn't too bad.
I want to hear more about that rage quit. When you rage quit, and what changed, what clicked that let you pick it up the next time?
So I'm not sure anything changed other than I'm just very aware it needs to happen. A language is a huge project, especially if you're treating it in the way that we're treating it, where it's not just, I think once upon a time you could just design a language, make a compiler, throw it over the fence and let the developers, you know, make build tools and tooling and all this stuff. No, these days you need everything. You need to have a formatter, you need to have a build tool, you need to have a package manager, you need to have all the things to be productive. And it's just a really big project. And I think the number one skill you need in doing this is not like a computer science background or to be some kind of coding genius or something. You just need to be really stubborn. It's gonna be a long time, and you just have to keep bashing your head against this wall over and over and over until it cracks. So I think I just had to find some of that stubbornness and go, okay, I've got a little bit of time. Let's try this thing again.
I mean, oftentimes stepping away from a problem is usually the best way to deal with the problem. You come back with a fresh head, and then usually the problem is not as bad as it once was when you were in the thick of it. So that was probably the best decision at the time.
I'll go with that. If you
yeah.
that makes what I did sound much more sensible.
Yeah, it's
amazing how with really complicated problems, there's something in your subconscious that it continues to process them even after you've stepped away. Because when I came back to fixing that, I said we released it and then there was a bug and we fixed it in the next version. That was quite a complicated bug. And I think if I tried to do that when I was first implementing it, or even when I was finishing it, I would have struggled a lot. I would have been very intimidated, and it was hard, but it wasn't as. But I did better than I thought I should have done. So the brain's an amazing thing. So I think all of us should make sure we go outside and have a walk in the park and walk the dog and play football and all that sort of thing more often, because that's a very powerful debugging technique.
Oh yeah.
If your boss asks what you're doing, just say that I said, you know, you've got to go
debugging.
Yeah. Got to go play on the swings.
Yeah. You mentioned prior to the 1.0 release, you wanted to make sure there were some success stories and, you know, people were betting their businesses on Gleam. Do you have any like case studies that you can share publicly, or, you know, even anonymously, maybe say how Gleam helped enable the business move forward?
So it wasn't that I wanted some companies to bet their business, although that would meet the goal. I wanted to be confident that people had written enough Gleam for us to discover things. So there are a lot of people who go, yeah, I like Gleam. I've read the introductory manual once, and I've installed it on my computer, but I've never written any of it. But they're still a Gleam fan, and they're about. And if you don't pay attention to them saying that, you might think that they're writing code. It could have been that I was the only Gleam programmer, but no, there's loads of people using it for all sorts of things. In terms of success stories, I really want people to say things about their use of Gleam. Everyone's very the more commercial a project gets, the less likely they are to want to say things about this risk they're taking, I find, which is annoying. I know there's people who are using it for their own stuff, which matches to them. That's wonderful. To me, that's just as important, because maybe a slightly bigger risk than lumping it into a company who just employs you. and there's people who use it in like really tiny little business things, but there's, I think there's a few people who are in you know, not companies, that's basically just them, who are very comfortably using Gleam, and I really want to get them to write something down. So hopefully soon I'll have something to share, but alas, not yet.
Yeah, there was one who was doing it a lot,
and that was Peter Saxon, wonderful guy. He made his whole startup with Gleam, but then they went bankrupt. I think that was market fit rather than Gleam. He's still my friend, so it can't have been that bad.
Yeah, I think we have him on to speak at Codebeam Stockholm Light.
Oh, that's great. Is there there's just one track at Stockholm Light, isn't there?
So it's a one-day, one track, and it's going to be very dense.
That's good. Because I was going to say, if there's two tracks, you should see his, but you don't get a choice. You just have to.
Actually, I'm going to have to be in Chattanooga, Tennessee at that particular date.
Oh. So.
Go Lars.
Yeah. Very in demand. Very in demand right now. No. But I'm curious about the kind of Gleam Elm comparison, and it's kind of unavoidable, I think, because they are similar languages and they both compile to JavaScript. Mm. How much of an effective kind of Elm replacement would Gleam be? Not that Elm necessarily needs replacing, but for people that perhaps see the benefit of potentially using the back end of Gleam as well.
I think it mostly I'll take this one. I think it mostly comes down to your opinions on FFI. That's the main one. So like, I spend a lot of time in the Elm community talking endlessly about Gleam, and so you hear a lot of people's perspectives and opinions. And pretty much if you're really on board with Elm's idea of being this nice sandbox where the outside world is completely separate, divorced from your program, then those people tend to find Gleam somewhat of a deal breaker as soon as they discover that you can FFI out to JavaScript or Erlang. But I think there's a huge, huge number of people which enjoy using Elm because it's the best option out there for the front end, where it was when they picked it up, but they don't necessarily love the fact that they can't easily pull in an NPM package, or they don't love that they have to write Haskell or Elixir or TypeScript for their back end. And for those people, I think Gleam is such a clear, easy sell. I spent like a full year in the Gleam community without even having the compiler installed, because my knowledge of Elm was enough to carry me through helping other people, which I think is just an incredible sell. Like, if you know Elm, you already know Gleam.
That's just a flex, that is. Haley's just showing off now. It's quite interesting because a lot of the Elm was an influence, but it's not the only influence. And on paper, the two languages do look very similar. There's a few notable differences, but I think the way that the community thinks about code overall is very different. Like, we're using a very similar set of tools, but the attitudes towards I don't know, things like purity and what being productive is are quite different. So there isn't quite as much of a sort of it seems to me like, so, you know, there might be quite easy for Elm people to move over, but I think those cultural things are actually much larger than I imagined, really. And there's much more people coming from other spaces. Like, Go is a big one. Because, like, Go is a really different language. Like, it's an object-oriented, mutable, it's still good at concurrency and stuff, but it's very different. But it has, in some ways, a very similar culture. Like, it's trying to be really small and practical and consistent. And the people who liked that about Go like that in a Beam setting. They like that in a functional setting. And if anything, a lot of those people say, "Oh, I really like Go because of, you know, I can make things like this. It's really easy. You can like pick it up really easily. It's pretty fast." But they're not actually in love with, you know, mutatable object-oriented programming. They would rather do some, you know, beamy functional programming. So that's a much stronger link than I thought there was going to be compared to Elm.
It seems like there's a common thread, right? So it's almost like the Elm community says that we're going to make Purity accessible. And what you're saying is that we're going to make Gleam accessible by making it more practical. Hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
On the FFI side, since that is kind of an important part, and from my experiences with Elm, it is kind of where the greatness is and the trouble starts. It's like you're dealing with ports because that's your option. Or you ask Haley on the down low in Berlin and you get a hack to work around the protections of Elm. Absolutely, absolutely illegal. Should not be done. Must not be done. But then I take it Purity is not necessarily front and center in Gleam. And I know it's not in the Beam. Like, the Beam can do whatever it likes at any time, essentially, aside from a bit of mutability. But what's the story with FFI? Foreign function interface, is that the proper expansion?
Mm-hmm. You got it.
How does that work, both on the JavaScript side and the Beam side?
So in the Gleam world, I think it's quite important to have an escape hatch, because I can build what I think is going to be a useful a framework, I suppose, for which you can make your application in. And I'm not super into frameworks for this reason, because I think they end up boxing you in quite a lot. Anything I make is going to have some opinions, which I think is going to be good, but may not necessarily work for your particular use case. And I think when you turn a corner and find yourself in this place where the rules don't work for you anymore, I want you to be able to have a way of getting out of that. And you know, to use the Elm for using Elm as an example, they've implemented a bunch of browser APIs, and if there is a, and they all look like normal Elm functions, that's really cool. But if there's a browser API that hasn't been given to you by the core team, well, then you've got to use ports. Suddenly you have to like completely restructure this entire part of the application to do this asynchronous message passing out into the impure world. I think you should just be able to say, okay, I'm gonna have to implement my own, you know, FFI function. And so in Gleam, you can just say, there is a function, it exists in the world. You can't verify this, Gleam compiler, because you can only analyze Gleam. You don't know anything about Erlang. You don't know anything about JavaScript. But trust me, it exists. And it takes these arguments, and it returns these arguments. And the compiler just says, okay, if you're wrong, this is your problem. And then, you know, continues with the rest of the program. And you can just call that any way you want. And Gleam is like, Gleam is to Erlang in the same way that Elixir is to Erlang. There isn't any runtime overhead. You know, after all the compilation is done, it is just the same Erlang bytecode. So you can just call any normal function, any normal Elixir or Erlang function any way you want.
I think some people will find that idea of, hey, you're going to tell me this function exists, and if it doesn't work, that's your problem. I think some people will find that really controversial in a statically typed language. Mm-hmm. But I actually think it's just pragmatic. Like, I actually just think there's a lot of scenarios in the real world where you need to build an actual thing, where you kind of have to accept that your program isn't a proof, and that it's okay to say, hey, like, I've got this function that I need to use. And I think it's actually a superpower of Gleam, is actually how simple that FFI is. There's not really any hoops you have to jump through to use it. But at the same time, it's a culture thing, right? Like, if we as a community can provide packages and bindings to useful things, then users themselves are going to be less incentivized to do naughty FFI things. And then really that escape hatch really just exists as an escape hatch for when it's really important.
And just to cue in our listeners, they can't see, but everyone was vigorously nodding like a whole shelf of bobbleheads in an earthquake.
But I think that is part of the, you know, the Beam culture. I think the Beam languages are interesting for functional languages, is that they're largely from practical applications. They're largely from industry. You know, they aren't made for, they don't come from academic research. Directly or indirectly so much. It's a bunch of people trying to solve real problems, whether it be Ericsson trying to build their telephone switch firmware, or Jose trying to, you know, make the next generation of web applications that can use all these multi-core processors that are coming about. Or it's me trying to, like, you know, stop waking myself in the middle of the night because I've got a undefined method on something that I keep accidentally calling. And so if you look at it from a position of getting shit done, you know, what is actually going to be more expensive? Getting that, you know, I'm 98% Gleam, and then I've got 2% Erlang code that just does something a bit, you know, naughty as far as the type system is concerned. Or, you know, restructuring your whole program to get to that, you know, to get to that 100%. If something goes wrong, you can probably just look at that 2%. You know, you really narrow down your whole area that you know that you've got certain guarantees in 98% of your program. So, like, you can tell that the problems are going to come from that boundary between the two systems. So I think it's quite a nice pragmatic balance, like giving the tools to do this, but also giving you lots of reasons why you don't want to. You know, your default is to do things the static way if you're doing it in Gleam.
And you also get the whole foundation of Erlang to build on. Like, okay, so FFI, you can write your own code. No. You can also just call Erlang. I guess that's the major use of FFI probably in many Gleam applications. It's like, oh, we need some crypto libs. I guess that's annoying to write. And most languages end up needing to trust some C code in the end, or they get really unwieldy about it.
But you know, if we were doing it from scratch and we weren't building on top of both Erlang OTP and the whole wider Hex ecosystem, this wouldn't be version one, or maybe it'd be version one, but there'd be no libraries. You know, we'd still be like, okay, well, how do we implement, I don't know, HTTP parsing? So, you know, really, really basic stuff. It would be another 5 years before anyone can do anything with it. So, yeah, it's really important to remember the Beam is a huge part of what makes Gleam exciting, and also JavaScript runtimes. There's a lot of value. You know, this is Beam Radio, but I think I'd say the JavaScript runtimes are pretty good as well. There's a lot of nice stuff there.
Yeah, languages are trade-offs, right? It's like we have to decide. It's we're all willing to be pure when we're talking about mutability, right? Because that's kind of what the foundation that we're based on, and the problems that you're solving are going to determine the trade-offs that you're willing to make, and that's what made 7 languages in 7 weeks fun, and that's kind of why this conversation is a good one, right?
This is all your fault, really, isn't it?
I don't know about that.
Are you able to infer any of the types from dialyzer specs or anything like that, or does it have to be formatted in like the Gleam FFI kind of syntax?
So you could theoretically, it's quite easy to reflect in Erlang to get that information, and you could then use that to generate some API bindings. But there's two problems. One of them is that there's three problems perhaps. One of them is that the expressiveness of dialyzers types and the future Elixir type systems types is greater than the expressiveness of Gleam's one. That sounds like it's being negative to Gleam, but it just means it's more constrained. Like we write our programs we are more precise with our data structures. There's not an obvious mapping always between the different types. Another thing is that a lot of the time, these type annotations are wrong, or they're only, or because Dialyzer is based around success typing, it's only correct in the happy path. Well, Gleam, we want full typing all the time, so we can't really rely on it and be confident that we're going to get out what we expect to. And like 2 section B, sometimes they just say any. A lot of them are just term, and then you're just.
I've never done that ever.
thank you for the annotation, but I haven't learned very
takes
much.
Takes a term and a term produces a term. What's the problem?
At least I know it's a function in that case. Good. The third, I can't remember. I don't know. Whatever number I'm up to now, but I think this is the real big one that stops me from trying to solve those earlier problems, is that I think APIs really want to be intentionally designed. Like we could generate bindings to all of the various different Elixir and Erlang APIs, but they were made for a slightly different model of programming. And just translating them one-to-one into a different context where you've got different capabilities, different data structures, different ways of thinking about problems, that's not going to get you the best, that's just not going to get you the best experience.
So are you dissing GraphQL and gRPC and all the generated API clients here? Oh, no!
Well, it's exactly like that. You know, you get... What is it? The Elixir AWS library, or is it Google Cloud?
Google Cloud one is kind of gnarly.
I think Twilio and Stripe are also generated the same way.
And they're like some sort of interchange format that's designed to look like a Java API that's been translated into
Elixir. I think it's based on the Open API spec generators. Yeah. Which
so the Google ones are not based on Open API, so I know that tool chain is like it generates Open API specs to be able to generate the code, and I toyed around with trying to make that less dumb and more performant. Like they're useful, but if you try to pull in one of the larger Google APIs, you will get 1,000 modules.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Without issue, which immediately affects your compile times.
Mm-hmm.
And I've toyed around with it, and it's like you can do this differently. Like you can make types for your maps. Not everything has to be a struct. Structs come with modules. It gets expensive.
I really want to have like a small number of really nice things more than, okay, let's take, you know, we could very easily take the top 1,000 packages on Hex. Well, not easily, but let's say we've built this tool. We could then take the top 1,000 packages and generate bindings for them. They would probably be rubbish and the ecosystem would all just feel a bit, you know, crusty. I don't want that. I want Gleam to be a lovely experience. So we're going to have to put a bit more work into it.
But can you like transpile a bunch of the Elm libraries and then just have a name generator slap cute names on them and
this is something we've actually spoken about, right? Like at least twice now. It's a recurring conversation in a desperate bid to lure more Elm people over.
it's dangerous because it feels like you can do it. It feels suspiciously doable, but it's probably not in any way worth the amount of time you put into it.
All right. I think we need to start wrapping up, but before we go, are there any cool developments in the Gleam space you specifically want to call out that we haven't asked you about?
Mm-hmm. I'm quite a fan of this Luster thing. I hear it's pretty cool. there's loads of really great stuff. We've got a version of the Hex site effectively, called packages.gleam.run, and it shows just the subset of Hex that is Gleam packages. And every time I go on there, that number of packages has jumped up again. So it's pretty tricky to keep track of all the things that are going on. Two things I personally really like as a big nerd are we've got Mist, which is a HTTP server, which I think the architecture is quite inspired by Bandit, so it has like very similar performance, which I think is really cool. Because not only is it quite satisfying that someone's made this complicated, this complicated thing that we can then use in our Gleam programs, it also just really shows that Gleam's OTP bindings can be as performant as the Erlang ones. That's really cool. And another one is a not yet finished due to a problem we've hit into with how the Beam allows you to access standard inputs. But it's a project called T-Shop. And if you could imagine that sort of, we talk about a lot of that reduction pattern of like having messages come in, you recompute the new state, and then you use that to like do something in the world. So if you're in a browser, you might render some HTML. If you're in live view, you might send some diffs across a wire. Well, this is that, but for terminal UI programs. So you can have like a really nice like interactive form or TUI or something like the command line version of the Explorer, but just made with this sort of nice reduction pattern. Unfortunately, there is a problem where we can't get all the keyboard inputs from the terminal because of, there's some API we need the OTP team to make not private. But I don't think we've made a proposal for that yet, but hopefully once we've got that, we can share it. Got any cool projects, Hayley?
My life is just entirely luster at the moment.
So. I know that sounds either like you're a little bit sick of it, or that your life is just full of luster, which sounds very good.
Go for it. I was just saying, you know, I try to check up on all the packages coming out, and a lot of them have the word luster in the name. Like, lots of people are making, it's either Haley's been making alt accounts and publishing things to trick me, or there are lots of people who are using this and extracting useful libraries out of it. So it's pretty cool.
I've been working on that library for maybe 2.5 years now, and for the first, say, 18 months, that library sat at like 20 GitHub stars. And then in the space of say like 2-3 weeks, it's like almost at 300 now. And so one of the most exciting developments is just so many people are coming in and like using it now. And I see on Twitter, like people talking about it without mentioning me. Like it's just a thing that people know exists now and is worth talking about, which is super exciting.
And now you have to maintain it forever.
Oh, I know. That's the worst bit. All these new people, and now suddenly I have to like do maintenance instead of push out features.
All right. Thank you both so much, and welcome to maintenance. all right. I'll just say thank you again to our sponsors. It's weird to thank yourself, but thank you, Underjord, and thank you, Groxio. Career fuel for programmers, and we will catch you all next time on Beam Radio. Bye.